On this week's 51%, it's one big history lesson. First, during this year that marks the 100th anniversary of guaranteeing women's right to vote, a professor talks about women who deserve more of the limelight.
I had hoped that the centennial would actually move us beyond Seneca Falls into the 20th century, but much of it did not.
And Jill Malkin has a profile of a woman in science. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
For we know it's all fudge to say man's the best judge of what should be and shouldn't and so on. That woman should bow nor attempt to say how she considers that matter should go on. I never yet gave up myself thus a slave, however my husband might try for it. For I can't and I won't, and I shan't and I don't, but I will speak my mind if I die for it.
Faculty members at the State University of New York at New Paltz have published a book about the legacy of women's suffrage in New York during a year marking the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, prohibiting states and the federal government from denying the right to vote based on sex. A few of the college's history and political science professors are among the contributors, and one contributor in particular contends there's more to the suffrage movement than the likes of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Suffrage and Its Limits, The New York Story, is a collection of essays edited and partially written by a collective of SUNY New Paltz faculty members. The book developed from an April 2017 conference celebrating the centennial of women winning suffrage in New York, which was co-hosted by the Benjamin Center at SUNY New Paltz and the FDR Presidential Library and Museum. Susan Lewis is a co-editor of the book.
The essence of the conference and the book was that we didn't want to just celebrate the centennial of women getting the vote in New York State. There have been a lot of celebrations, and I have to tell you, I don't approve of all of them. You know, some have been wonderful, but a lot of them, it's almost like they put women in this category where anything they do is so amazing that obviously you're going to celebrate it. And what we wanted to bring was a more scholarly eye to say, okay, what really happened? How can we complicate this story? How are we going to move beyond Anthony and Stanton, for instance, which so many of the centennial celebrations seem to focus on? And Allison, they died and failed. I'm sorry. Their tactics were not successful. I don't think it was their fault. I think that the United States was not ready for women's suffrage in 1848 or 1869 or 1900. But nevertheless, we can't learn the lessons of the successful suffrage movement from looking at them. We have to move beyond that to the people who actually got women's suffrage. And then we need to look at why women's suffrage did not translate into equality for women.
Wait, Susan, why then, given what you just said, I'm so sorry to cut in, but I've got to know this. Why has there been so much attention? And I mean, you know, obviously from a scholarly view, not, you know, just because it's easy to talk about those two names. Why has there been so much focus on that when that's a fact of what you just said?
I don't know. The truth is, I really don't know.
Okay.
I've got to say that part of it has to do with tourism in the western part of the state. You know, the western part of the state has a lot of tourism built around Seneca Falls. And everybody at least recognizes the name Seneca Falls, and they tend to latch onto that. I had hoped that the centennial would actually move us beyond Seneca Falls into the 20th century, but much of it did not. Some of it did. You know, there was a fabulous show at the New York State Museum, and there have been wonderful books. We have a chapter in our book by Karen Pastorello and Susan Goodyear, which takes their entire book about suffrage in New York and condenses it into one single chapter. I mean, that alone is worth the price of this book, because many people just don't have the time or attention, or it's a student project, to read an entire book. But in reading this chapter, you can find out exactly, precisely, in meticulous detail, how women got the vote in New York and the many groups that were responsible. So they're focusing on male support. They're focusing on rural support. They're focusing on African American women. But they are focusing on the period right between 1915 and 1917 where women get the vote in New York and then nationally.
So who should we be crediting? Who should be in the chapter headlines?
This is so interesting because I have a huge bee in my bonnet about this. The woman who is most responsible, I'm just going to say this, for getting the vote in New York and nationally, I believe, is Carrie Chapman Catt. And most Americans and New Yorkers have never even heard of her. I'll tell you, you know, when I speak to groups, which I do on a regular basis of citizens, or I speak to classes, very rarely has anyone heard of her. They have heard of Alice Paul. Alice Paul is more dramatic, and actually, I know someone who made the proposition that it was really because Alice Paul and the protests around the White House were not just more dramatic, but they were more photogenic. What does Carrie Chapman Catt do? She lobbies. Lobbying does not make a good photograph. It's not a dramatic story. But the truth is that women couldn't get the vote unless they convinced men. So I've got here the PBS series that's just coming out, and it says, women weren't given the vote, they took it. No, this is such a lie, because they could not take it. They did not have the power to take it. They did not form a revolution. They convinced men to vote for it in states and nationally. And so how do you do that? You actually don't do that, I don't think, by picketing the White House and calling the president the Kaiser in the middle of World War I. You do that by convincing the president and other legislators on the state level and on the national level that women deserve to vote.
What specifically does your contribution cover?
My contribution covers my polemic on Carrie Chapman Catt.
So let's get into that a little bit. Why don't you delve a little deeper during our conversation?
Sure. Well, first of all, getting the vote in New York State is the most important thing because although there were many other states where women had the vote, New York is the first state east of the Mississippi where women get the full right to vote. They get the right to vote in every election, not just, say, school boards or not local or not just presidential. There are all different kinds of voting patterns across the U.S. But by focusing on New York, not only Catt, but Catt's partner, Mary Garrett Hay, becomes like the New York organizer. And what sets New York suffrage, why it wins in 1917, where it didn't win in 1915. In 1915, they have a referendum. It fails. The next morning, Catt gets up and says, someone says, what are you going to do now? And she says, we're going to start organizing right now. We're going to have a big meeting tonight. We're going to raise a lot of money. But she is then taken to be the head of the national organization. So her partner, Mary Garrett Hay, takes charge of the New York campaign. And what she does is, the city campaign, what she does is she gets Tammany Hall on their side. How does she do that? By taking Tammany's wife's leaders, the wives of the Tammany leaders, and getting them on committees and getting them involved. So Tammany, for the first time, does not reject women's suffrage. Instead, it just stands aside and is sort of neutral. And in fact, we know now that what puts women's suffrage over, the referendum over in New York City, are actually the votes of socialist men. But there are many aspects of this. But let's say, okay, so we get the vote in New York. That's important because New York is the biggest, most populous state, and therefore it has the most representatives in Congress, and therefore there's going to be a huge voting block for women's suffrage. So here's another reason we know Catt was important. When the amendment has to go through Congress and it passes, and then it goes to the states, and it's ratified by enough states, they only need one more state. But what they've got left is the South. So they're very concerned that the South will reject suffrage and it won't be ratified. And the next thing that happens is the amendment fails in Delaware. The state after that is Tennessee. And they go to Tennessee, and Kat goes to Tennessee, although she has mostly local organizers working there. Alice Paul doesn't go to Tennessee, and I would say that's because, you know, she knows she's just too controversial, and it wouldn't help. In any case, it comes down to one vote, one single vote, by a guy named Harry Byrne. Harry Byrne is a young man, I think he's 24, and he's planning to vote against it because the people of his, you know, district are against it. And he gets a letter from his mother, and his mother actually writes, "Be a good boy, Harry, and give Mrs. Catt what she wants." "Mrs. Catt," she says, and he changes his vote, and women get the right to vote in the United States.
I adore that anecdote.
That changed
history. I mean, you're talking about Kat as the woman who changed, you know, history and in turn, but it's really Harry's mother.
Oh, Phoebe, I think her name is, I've had students who say she was the most responsible person, and she's, you know, living in a rural part of Tennessee, but she knows who Carrie Chapman Catt is, and she knows that women should vote. She actually, I think, says something like, "If it comes down to your vote, Harry, be a good boy." So there are many, many other women. I could give you the names of 25 women, maybe 50, who were really important in the suffrage movement.
So what's next after this book?
Well, I would say a lot of books have come out recently about women's suffrage nationally and in New York State. And so I think we finally have the scholarship that we needed in order to start addressing these questions more in a less celebratory and a more complicated way. And so I would say that I think there's a tremendous opportunity now not to leave the centennial behind us, which is what I'm afraid of. It's like, do you know how people will say, well, we already have a woman on that committee, or we already have a woman on our faculty, or we already have a Latina, you know, or we already have a black person, we don't need any more representation. I'm worried that that might happen with this centennial, and people will say, well, we already talked about women's suffrage, why would we talk about it anymore? And I've got to say, this was the largest expansion of democracy in American history. And if you look at a college history textbook, it's often sort of either slid in at the end of World War I, or it's just not, it just doesn't get enough space. So I'm hoping that there will be more space in public debate, in scholarly debate, in classrooms, in teaching. What I usually teach people who are going to be teachers, you know, future teachers. So I'm hoping that this will reach future teachers so the next generations coming up will learn something about women's suffrage and women's rights.
Director of the Benjamin Center for Public Policy Initiatives, K.T. Tobin, contributes a chapter on women in local politics.
Women can also not just vote for leaders, but actually be leaders themselves. So a lot of the chapters on the present is about just that, you know, how, where are we at in terms of the composition of our elected political bodies, and is there equity there? And the answer is no. Among the 50 states in terms of representation in state legislatures, New York is, I think about 19th, yes. In general, women's level of elected office nationally and in the state plateaued after hitting about, you know, 1 in 5 seats in the early 90s, and then, you know, kind of sat there for a while. And then in 2018, women ran for office in record numbers, and New York was part of that, including having the first black woman elected statewide, attorney general, AOC elected to Congress, the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. So there's been a lot of firsts, But whether you look at the national numbers or closer to home here in New York State, you're still looking at about a quarter of the U.S. Senate, about a quarter of the House of Representatives, just under 3 in 10 of state legislatures and statewide elected seats are held by women. So there's still a long way to go in terms of elected representation to get to gender parity.
Tobin is also deputy mayor of the Village of New Paltz and talks about New York's specific statistics.
About 93% of town clerks are women, and almost all the highway superintendents and sheriffs are men. So it's gendered, we would say, in that there's roles and responsibilities associated with gender that are reflected in the types of participation, even at the elected level, that women, that's their input is gendered in a way that, you know, it's more likely to be part-time, less prestigious seats, and with things that are more associated with, you know, what we would call feminized occupations. And on the other side, things like sheriffs and highway superintendents and being the top dog, like the executive or the mayor, those masculine seats are more likely to still be held by men.
Again, Lewis, who is emerita professor of history.
I would really love for this book to be in libraries. And I would really love for this book to be a resource ongoing for students, high school or college, even middle school students, I think, could learn a lot from this book. I think this book would be interesting to any woman politician, any woman interested in politics in New York State. I think this book corrects a lot of misconceptions and opens up new areas for discussion.
Suffrage and Its Limits, The New York Story, includes a preface from New York Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul and a final chapter by activist Barbara Smith. It's published by SUNY Press.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women who made possible a century of progress, women like Dawn Staley, a Hall of Fame basketball player and coach who grew up playing against the boys in her North Philadelphia neighborhood. Staley always said she expressed herself through basketball. She was the 1988 National High School Player of the Year and then National College Player of the Year twice and a five-time All-Star playing for the WNBA. Staley won 3 Olympic gold medals as a player and now heads up the U.S. team and is head coach at the University of South Carolina. The WNBA created the Dawn Staley Community Leadership Award to recognize her longtime commitment to giving back. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
1953, Toni Stone became the first woman to play professional baseball on a men's team for the Indianapolis Clowns, who, it was said, had mostly hired her as a novelty. The Negro Leagues were hurting after Jackie Robinson integrated baseball in 1947. Now it seemed the best players and their fans were being funneled off by the major leagues. Toni Stone didn't care if she was there just to draw crowds, because at least she got to play baseball, the game that had obsessed her going back to her sandlot days as a girl in St. Paul, Minnesota. She played second base and hit for the Indianapolis Clowns, but a reporter writing about the curvy rookie made sure to note her jersey, sized to accommodate a 36-inch bust. Stone's teammates suggested she go back to the kitchen, and opponents spiked her when they slid into second. Still, she took it and played ball with the men, because the only female league, which would fold in a year anyway, was whites only. Overlooked then, Toni Stone would be remembered later with a book and 2 plays based on her life.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
The U.S. Department of Labor and Princeton University have reached agreement to resolve pay disparities for professors, specifically to resolve allegations of paying women less. While not admitting liability in the investigation, Princeton University agreed to an early resolution conciliation agreement. Princeton University has agreed to pay $925,000 in back pay and at least $250,000 in future salary adjustments to resolve allegations of compensation discrimination by the Labor Department. Findings by the Labor Department's Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs showed that between 2012 and 2014, there were pay disparities for 106 female employees in the full professor position. Princeton University agreed to take steps to ensure its compensation practices meet legal requirements and conduct statistical analyses to determine if any significant disparities exist against female full professors. Princeton also agreed to conduct pay equity training for all individuals involved in compensation decisions for full professors, including the consideration of factors that may result in pay disparities. In early October, Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna were awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the development of a method for genome editing. They made history as the first all-woman team to receive a Nobel Prize in science. They hope it will inspire a new generation of women in science. Gilles Malkin brings us a profile of another Nobel Prize winner from his Women in History series.
It is generally assumed that men are the greatest warriors and are the front line of humanity's defenses. But I'd like to tell about a woman who took on an enemy so vast it could not be counted, so elusive it could not be seen, and so strong that before her we couldn't even conceive of weapons against it. Gertrude Bell Elion was born in New York City in 1918 to Lithuanian and Polish immigrant parents. As a youngster, she was deeply affected by the death of her grandfather from cancer. It oriented her toward a life of contributing to the well-being of others. Thanks to her voracious thirst for knowledge and her excellent grades, she was admitted to Hunter College at 15 and was later graduated summa cum laude in 1937 at 19 with a degree in chemistry. The crash of 1929 ruined her family's finances and she was unable to pursue a PhD. She sought work in her field, but had to take other unrelated jobs just to make ends meet, since women were not considered to be able to make the grade as chemists. It wasn't until World War II, when male chemists became scarce, that Elion was able to find a position assisting George Hitchings at an amply funded British pharmaceutical company. Until that time, the traditional way of finding solutions to counter malignant cells was largely by trial and error and required long periods of waiting time. Elion set out on a new course, that of attempting to directly interfere with the malignant cells' needs for their growth. Her first success was partial. She did find a way to halt the formation of leukemia cells, resulting in a reversal of the disease, but it was temporary in too many patients. Generally, the idea of antiviral drugs was not considered viable because it was thought that the toxicity of such substances would surely kill the patient. But Elion did not give up, and she and her team finally succeeded in developing a drug that would effectively fight sarcoma, malaria, herpes encephalitis, Epstein-Barr, chickenpox, and shingles. On her path, she discovered another helpful drug, azathioprine, sold under the name of Imuran. It was crucial to suppress the immune system of patients during the process of organ transplants in order to prevent rejection, which is what this compound achieved. But her greatest success was yet to come. Her work led directly to the development of AZT, the substance used today to treat and prevent HIV/AIDS. It's used in conjunction with other antivirals to prevent its spread, even to the degree that it can help prevent mothers from transferring the virus to their newborns. Trudy Elion's prime interest was curing people of disease. She also spent a good deal of time teaching girls that they could have a role in science. What she considered her highest reward was the countless number of photos and letters of thanks she received from patients whose lives had been affected by her work. She said, When you meet someone who's lived for 25 years with a kidney graft, there's your reward. It's amazing how much you can accomplish when you don't care who gets the credit. The door she opened created an enormous field of work based on her principle. Since the 1980s, scientists have adopted a genomic approach to analyze the weaknesses of a virus so as to attack its mode of sustenance and reproduction, to be specifically detrimental to the virus's survival over the course of its life cycles, without doing harm to the body's cells. Today, antivirals are safe to the degree that they're widely used in treating viral infections as well as influenza and hepatitis. Drugs can now be designed even to inhibit a virus's ability to target a healthy cell, an approach that seems to require less toxicity than waiting to attack it after it's entered a cell. Gertrude Ellion was awarded an honorary PhD from Polytechnic University of New York and an honorary Doctor of Science degree from Harvard University. In 1991, she received the National Medal of Science and became the first woman to be inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. In 1988, she was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for her revolutionary approach to drug development. Gertrude Ellion died of a stroke on February 21, 1999, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, musician, actor, composer, and advocate for people with disabilities. He lives in upstate New York. His Women in History series contains essays that depict the lives and accomplishments of women who made a difference against significant odds. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1631.